Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, April 26, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear a Courthouse Steps telephone on the Supreme Court case Amgen Inc. v. Sandoz, which was argued in the Supreme Court today. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Mr. Andrew A. Hufford, an intellectual property attorney at Brinks, Gilson, and Leone. I will turn it over to Andrew to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Andrew. The floor is yours.
Thank you, and good afternoon and welcome. Today we will be discussing this morning's U.S. Supreme Court argument in Amgen versus Sandoz. As noted, any opinions expressed are my own and do not reflect the opinions of Brinks, Gilson, and Leone or its clients. So this case involves construction of two provisions of the Biologics Price Competition and Innovation Act of 2009. The BPCIA provides a framework for regulatory approval of biologic products that are shown to be biosimilar to a licensed reference product. It also outlines an orderly mechanism for resolving patent disputes before a biosimilar is launched. The BPCIA is principally found at 42 U.S.C. Section 262. Subsection K of that statute allows any person to submit an application for licensing a biological product. Under subsection L2A of the statute, not later than 20 days after the FDA notifies a subsection K applicant that the application has been accepted for review, the applicant shall provide to the reference product sponsor a copy of the application and such other information that describes the process or processes used to manufacture the biological product. So providing this K application and other information triggers an exchange of patent list and contentions under subsections L3 through L6 of the Act to identify patents for later infringement action. So parties to this so-called patent dance are given a safe harbor from declaratory actions under certain circumstances until agreement is reached on this patent list. Subsection L8A separately provides that the K applicant shall provide notice to the reference product sponsor not later than 180 days before the date of the first commercial marketing of the biological product licensed under subsection K. Under L8B, this notice then allows the sponsor to request a preliminary injunction preventing the applicant from sale or manufacture until validity, enforcement, and infringement are resolved by the court, at least for patents that are defined through that patent dance. So in this case, in July 2014, Sandoz filed a subsection K application naming Amgen's Neupogene, which is filgrastim, as the reference product. And shortly after, the FDA accepted its application for review, but before approval, Sandoz notified Amgen that it intended to market its biosimilar, called Zarxio, immediately upon approval. But Sandoz declined to provide its application or manufacturing information under subsection L2A. Sandoz advised Amgen, however, that it could sue immediately for infringement of its patents. Amgen then asserted state law claims of conversion and unlawful competition and infringement of one of its method of use patents in the Northern District of California. Amgen argued that Sandoz had unlawfully obtained the benefit of the BPCIA to shortcut its approval process without providing the required disclosure under L2A, and it sought an order requiring Sandoz to provide this disclosure and declaring Sandoz's L8A Notice of Commercial Marketing ineffective as being premature. The district court granted summary judgment for Sandoz, holding that the disclosure provisions of L2A were optional and that the applicant may give its L8A notice before FDA approval. On appeal to the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, Amgen pointed to the express language of subsection L2A, stating that the K applicant shall provide its application and other information, and noting that it needed this information to decide which patents that it would be able to assert. Amgen also relied on the text of subsection L8A, arguing that the biological product licensed under subsection K meant the product after it was licensed, and noting that applications routinely change during FDA review, so an earlier notice before actual approval was insufficient. Sandoz countered that when the statute was read as a whole, subsection L2A is only mandatory if the applicant chooses to participate in this patent dance. And notably, despite the shall language of L2A, the statute later provides at subsection L9C that if a subsection K applicant fails to provide the application and information required under 2A, the reference product sponsor, but not the subsection K applicant, may bring an action for a declaration of infringement, validity, or enforceability of any patent that claims a biological product or a use of the biological product. So Sandoz argued at the Federal Circuit that this language showed a congressional intent that the shall language of L2A was not mandatory. And Sandoz also argued that requiring the K applicant to wait until approval to provide its L8A notice of commercial marketing granted an unjust windfall of an additional 180 days of exclusivity after, in many cases, the sponsor's original biological application had already expired. The Court of Appeals affirmed on the first issue that disclosure under L2A was optional because of these default provisions in the statute, but it reversed on the second issue, holding that notice under L8A is only effective after FDA approval. And it enjoined Sandoz from marketing until 180 days had run from the date of that approval. But Judge Lurie at the Federal Circuit also commented that the statute should be given some kind of a Pulitzer Prize for unclarity. The Supreme Court granted cert on both issues. Arguing this morning for Sandoz was Deanne Maynard of Morrison Foerster. She is a former Assistant U.S. Solicitor General and was the counsel who argued the case at the Federal Circuit for Sandoz. Arguing for Amgen was Seth Waxman from Wilmer Hale, a former U.S. Solicitor General and somebody who's well known to the Supreme Court bar. So in the actual arguments, Sandoz addressed the court first and opened with the argument that there was no 180-day automatic stay provided in the statute. This by contrast, incidentally, to the automatic stay that you might be familiar with the Hatch-Waxman Act. This opened an active exchange about whether and when the FDA communicated an intent to the subsection K applicant to license before the biosimilar was actually licensed. Sandoz noted that biosimilars can take 8 to 10 years to develop and that the statute prevents the FDA from approving until the reference product sponsor's 12-year exclusivity period has expired, also noted that the FDA generally aims to approve these applications within about 10 months. So Justice Kennedy went a little bit further with the questioning, asking, do you get a phone call or something? And Sandoz counsel said no. Justice Kennedy then commented that this aspect would cut against Sandoz regarding the 180-day notice, saying that it seems that notice has to run from when it's actually licensed. Justice Breyer jumped in and pushed the issue a little further. He asked, how could you do that, which is to provide notice, how could you do that if you don't even have the product that's actually licensed, calling this a crucial ambiguity in the statute. This opened a separate exchange principally between Justice Breyer and counsel for Sandoz about whether the FDA should be asked to weigh in or present some regulations on the question. He added that it would be more convincing if the FDA as an expert agency had actually done so as to what this 180-day notice should run from. Sandoz commented that if the Federal Circuit had it right, meaning the decision that was reached in the lower court, the license would never be effective until 12 and a half years. She commented that the parties are highly incentivized to go through this exchange process, which is an interesting exchange because, Sandoz didn't go through the exchange process, as it turned out. So this opened another discussion about how the reference product sponsor would know what to actually sue on under Sandoz's argument. Justice Sotomayor weighed in here. and asked, how could a company have a good faith basis to bring suit if they don't even have the application to look at before discovery? And this is another case where it looks like the court's kind of switching back and forth between the L2A disclosure provision and the L8A notice of commercial marketing provision. But Sandoz's remark was yes, it would have a good faith basis, commenting that the biosimilar, the language of what a biosimilar is in the statute, is it's a drug product that's highly similar to the reference product, and basically saying that because there's such a similarity in the actual products that that we would be, as the reference product sponsor, we would know whether or not we could sue, and we would have a good faith basis based on that. Justice Roberts commented that similar doesn't mean identical, and Sandoz counsel remarked that any product or use of the product should give a good faith basis, which is interesting from a patent litigator perspective, is whether that really would fly. But parties, according to Sandoz, will have, again, a powerful incentive to follow through. And Justice Sotomayor commented as an aside that all incentives have a way of failing. Sandoz finally at the end of their argument commented that the purpose of the notice was to lift the gate against litigation within the statute, allowing a declaratory judgment or a preliminary injunction proceeding to go forward, and commented that the sponsor has great control over this first round of litigation. There are a number of amicus briefs submitted, one of which was from the U.S. and U.S. Assistant Solicitor General Yang spoke on behalf of Sandoz and argued that no private right of action exists for enforcing the BPCIA, and said that it would muck up the statute for courts to police each step of the patent dance. Justice Kennedy then asked, said that if the statute says the applicant shall provide the application under L2A, but perhaps an agency can delay the review process if it's not complied with, to which Mr. Yang commented that the FDA had declined participating in a rulemaking process in this case. This opened up an extended preemption exchange, starting with Justice Gorsuch, who was fairly active in these questions. He asked, why was preemption never argued regarding the state law claims? Because, as we recall, the original case was brought to Northern District of California under primarily state law claims. Mr. Yang answered that the Federal Circuit deemed the state law claims moot, and they applied a federal injunction, but commented that there are strong arguments that this would be preempted if the states happened to intervene at each step along the way. Justice Sotomayor said that if it's not preempted, how would a state law claim fail? And Mr. Yang said that the exclusive remedy would be a DJ action. Amgen next weighed in and opened its comments by arguing that Congress did not create a detailed procedure and use the word shall to have applicants disregard these mandates. And incidentally, if you look at the statute, the word may is used, I believe, about 27 times, and the word shall is used about 68 times, which kind of suggests that Congress had an idea of what it was actually doing when it used those terms. Amgen next took kind of an unusual tactic of opening the floor for questions without undergoing what Mr. Waxman called a prolonged tutorial on the statute. And Justice Sotomayor took the invitation, opening up a discussion about this notice issue. Justice Sotomayor said, wouldn't notice after approval stop the Phase 2 litigation from starting, and wouldn't Amgen's reading force the Round 2 or the Phase 2 litigation into this post-license period, meaning that we would always be dealing with litigation after that 12-year period had actually expired for the reference product sponsor's exclusivity? And Amgen said no, didn't really elaborate that much, but said that the purpose of the statute was to complete all patent litigation before the drug launched, but acknowledged that nobody has actually applied yet for one of these biosimilar applications until well after the 12-year period had expired. And note that we're only dealing with about 5 biosimilar applications that have been approved at this point. So this opened up an interesting tutorial from Mr. Waxman, in spite of his original opening remarks, about the differences between the Hatch-Waxman Act and biosimilars. And he noted that the notice was only coherent, or he argued that notice was only coherent when the FDA announces which molecule is actually being approved for what uses. And the differences, as he characterized them, is in the Hatch-Waxman Act, you're dealing with small molecules that are well-characterized. And if I'm a follow-on applicant in the Hatch-Waxman context, then the molecule that I'm going to be producing needs to be identical to the original reference product, to use the language of the VPCIA. And the precise purposes are going to be known under the Hatch-Waxman regime, and nobody really cares, as he said it, regarding how the actual molecule is processed or manufactured. In the case of a biosimilar, until the FDA decides exactly which process and purposes and molecule are going to be approved, the K applicant can't give notice of anything. And so his point was that notice that is provided for the first time when it's required under L8A allows the sponsor to seek a preliminary injunction against the product for those uses, but you can't go to the district court unless you actually have the information that is specifically relevant to the injunction, meaning that you need to know what the product is and what the processes are, or else the court can't actually evaluate that, especially in the injunction context. Justice Gorsuch then asked, he said, well, shall means shall. He sort of conceded that point, but the question remains, what is the appropriate remedy? Amgen then went into a discussion about the California statute that was actually sued on, and noted that violation of this California statute, let me rephrase that, violation of a federal law would constitute violation of the California statute that was actually sued upon. And Justice Sotomayor suggested that the term shall would only be applicable if you wanted to invoke the federal process. But Amgen said, well, that subsection L9C was actually an exception to subsection 9A, and that L9C, which is this this sort of default provision, if the subsection K applicant doesn't provide its L2A application, is only a, sort of the exception to what normally would be a background right already on the part of the parties to bring a DJ action anyway. And so he's basically describing or characterizing why the right of action already exists. Justice Roberts kind of talked about how reticulated the statute was, and commented that you have a statute that's a federal statute, and all of a sudden up pops California law. So if there's no federal cause of action, can you just proceed under state law to get your remedy? And Mr. Waxman for Amgen said that the only remedy under the California statute was an injunction. He said that you can't provide notice of something when you don't actually know what's going to happen. Justice Kagan then said that the statute contemplates that you can do a lot of this litigation before your 8A notice is actually received, and you don't need the notice to start evaluating whether there's infringement in round one, to which counsel for Amgen said that 180 days is a period of time needed for the parties to evaluate the real dispute after that period of potential patent exchange that happens in the patent dance. And the district court and district judge would also need that time to evaluate later on in the proceedings. This is followed by rebuttal argument from Sandoz counsel, who commented that they told Amgen to sue them, which brought some kind of good humor from some of the justices up in the front. And she, arguing for Sandoz, said that the shall conditions are all conditions precedent. They don't mean must, but only they do mean must, rather, but only if the parties want to continue in the process. So as I mentioned to date, there's only five at this point approved biosimilars, but several more may be approved this year. And some companies like Amgen are actually finding themselves as sponsors for some drugs and as biosimilar applicants for other drugs, which is going to create an interesting litigation maze until the boundaries of this statute are further defined. But with that, I'm happy to take any questions that people might have.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for that first question, let me ask one of my own. What do you think the outcome of the case will be?
Well, of course, you can never predict. You don't have the crystal ball for that. But, you know, it's interesting because a lot of the recent Supreme Court cases that are best known have kind of gone against the Federal Circuit. My sense, just from the questioning of the people that did ask questions on the panel with the court, is at least for the 180-day notice of commercial marketing, it seems like they are potentially leaning in Amgen's favor, which is to affirm the Federal Circuit on that issue. There's sort of this reticulated notion of L2A and just how much sort of crosstalk there are between explicit language in the statute and sort of exceptions that are written into the statute. It's a little bit unclear whether the intent of Congress is actually fully embraced within the express language of that statute. If the goal is to actually drive the parties and properly incentivize them to participate in the patent dance, it's questionable whether that's really what the patent, what the statute is actually doing. But my sense is that we could see an affirmance on both issues, but again, it's really hard to predict, especially on that first issue with the L2A disclosure requirement.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I'll make an announcement for next week's programming. Our next telephone conference call is scheduled for Tuesday, May 2nd. That call will feature J.D. Vance, author of Hillbilly Elegy, and Adam White, research fellow at the Hoover Institution. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for a question, I'll ask another. Did Gorsuch participate in the arguments?
He did, and he was actually fairly active. I would say probably Justices Sotomayor and Breyer were the most active, but Gorsuch took a pretty active part in the questioning, especially on the preemption issue. So we have a federal statute with a fairly complex series of shalls and mays, but as I mentioned, the cause of action that was brought by Amgen in the Northern District of California was primarily a state law claim. And so he was quite interested in why preemption hadn't been argued previously, and whether it was appropriate for a state law or a state court to be under state law to be forcing the parties to dance, if you will.
To ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls, and you can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforum conference calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you may have missed. Well, I'll make a final call for questions. If you have a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. With that, do you have any final remarks you'd like to make?
No, I think there's actually a fairly limited amount of litigation out there, but one thing that's interesting about these biosimilars is that everyone that gets approved is a headline maker, and we're talking about a multi-billion dollar industry, as the justices sort of repeated many times in some of their questioning. It will be interesting to see if the statute gets revised in any way. But it will also be interesting. I think we're expecting some sort of a decision maybe in June or July. I don't think we've heard the last of this BPCIA litigation, including potentially up to the highest court. So I think there's a lot more to come here in this area.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.